Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Conversation and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network, and also you will find on other shows on the Patriot Journalist Network is Charlotte Dively's show, Pray USA, which is on, I believe, from varying times, and then there's also Mark Prasik's live video chat, which is from 8 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time. And then, of course, you will find Bard's Logic Political Talk on there as well from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Sunday through Thursday. And one way to find the Patriot Journalist Network page, if you are a Facebook user, is to just go up to your search engine and put in Patriot Journalist Network, and then you will find the Facebook application. Another way to find it is on the Blog Talk Radio homepage of Bard's Logic Political Talk, and you can find a link to the website, this show's website, and on the page called the About the Show page on the website, at the bottom you will also find a link to the Patriot Journalist Network. And also, part of the conservative conversation are shows such as Samuel Sanford's show, which is Constitutional Conservatives Unite, which you can find that every night from 11 p.m. till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. And that is, as I said, every night. And then also on Friday and Saturday evenings, you will find the Tex and Rex show, which is run from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Now, tonight, I'm going to have a special guest this evening, and that is a Dr. Blahnik, and he is an author, a philosopher, a playwright, and a professor. And so he's got a pretty full resume. Now, Dr. Blahnik has earned a Bachelor of Arts in Linguistics and Religion from California State University, Fullerton, and he has multiple master's degrees. He has a master in English from Xavier University and also a master's degree in counseling from Xavier University. And he has a third master's degree in philosophy from the University of Cincinnati. And he has a PhD in humanities at the Union Institute and University. He has taught a wide variety of philosophy courses focusing on ethics at various colleges and universities. Gary published 4 original works in philosophy, developing a new philosophical perspective, which is called, is experientialism is the name of the new philosophical perspective, in which he seeks to integrate mind and body, spirit and matter, and traditional relativism with traditional objectivism. He has one work in psychology where he applies his philosophical perspective to psychotherapeutic theory and practice, seeking to challenge the assumptions of current theory and practices of psychotherapy. He has 10 full-length plays where he seeks to push the boundaries of theater and 2 novels, which he will be talking about tonight. And, of course, he will be talking about other issues if the folks have any questions after the body of the interview, especially if those who will be interested in what he has to say about experientialism. And also, after working in social work and counseling for more than a decade, Dr. Blahnik developed a strong interest in human social hierarchies and the effect that these form of human organization have upon the mental and physical health. And in response to his opinion of the harmful effects of hierarchy and to his interest in drama, he is in the process of developing a democratic form of business, which perhaps he'd be willing to talk about that as well tonight, referred to as Associated Independent Dramatic Artists. In doing so, he hopes to create a viable form of human organization where equality replaces power differences and where human mental and physical health will be improved. Now, tonight we have Dr. Blahnik slated to come in at approximately 9:15. So in about 6 minutes, we are going to have him in. And as I said, after the interview, we will have a question and answer session from the audience if they wish to ask. So as we wait for him, the first song that you heard tonight as the opening song, normally you hear We Are Soldiers, But this opening song for tonight, since it's a different theme, we're kind of moving away from the politics for tonight, which, I mean, it might intercede itself at some, or, you know, come in, into play at some points, perhaps, in the night show, but which happens. We usually shy away from that, and the opening song is kind of an illustration of that attempt. So while we wait, and as I said, you should be coming in another 5 minutes. I will play another song here by Aubrey Ashburn, in which that's who was the first one. And you can hear more of her music from www.aubrey, A-U-B-R-E-Y, Ashburn, A-S-H-B-U-R-N, .com. And you can also listen to a interview which she was stayed on for an hour and 15 minutes that I had with her on her music and her career. And you can also find that in the archive section of my Blog Talk Radio Show page, but you can also find a way to listen to the archive through the selected episodes on the that you will find on the homepage of the Bard's Logic Political Talk website. Now, if you are new to the show, then I would ask that whether you're new through the archives or if you are new through listening live, thank you, of course, for coming. But also, if you'd like to follow the show, it's pretty simple. Just on the homepage, you'll see the icon, the show's icon, and underneath is a little follow button. If you just click that, you can go ahead and follow the show, and I'd really appreciate it. But while we're waiting for Dr. Blahnik to come in, I will, as I said, play another song from Aubrey Ashburn. And here we go. Dr. Blahnik should be in at any time, but while we wait, perhaps he might be a little bit behind schedule this evening, and hopefully we don't have a repeat of what we had a couple nights ago where we had a gentleman who was interviewed and did not come in to the show, but we're working on the possibility of having him on, and that was Rod Class of what I believe is the Constitution Party, and perhaps someone can correct me on that, but I believe so. So hopefully we'll at some other time have him in. So while we're waiting, I would also like to go ahead and play another song by Aubrey Ashburn. And please enjoy, and if it, I may cut off the song short if our guest comes in before the conclusion. I believe our special guest is on the line here. So let me open up the line and see if this is Dr. Blahnik.
Speaking.
Yes, this,
yeah. Hi, Rob.
Yes. Hey, hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, my pleasure.
Great, great. Great to have you on. We can just go straight into the interview if you like. I've been reading through some things, and I might have some other questions after we go through the interview, especially if you'd like to expound more on the some of the things I told the audience about, and to inform you what those were.
Nope.
Is I talked briefly about your two things. One, your new philosophical perspective, experientialism, and maybe we can discuss that more. Well, I didn't know. I told him that I was reading a bio from you, and so I thought maybe later on we could go into that somewhat if you like. Or, and also about we have here that I have in the bio, you know, as I said, we could cover this at some other time, but also about the Associated Independent Dramatic Arts where you talk about the hierarchical structures and how you're trying to make a new, I guess, type of business based on something different.
Yeah, given the format of your show, yeah, that probably would be of interest to the people who listen to your show. Yeah.
Definitely. Okay, so what we'll do here is, and of course this is, these shows are archived, so they'll also be give the audience an opportunity to listen to an archived section if they weren't able to tonight. So that being said, I'd like to thank everyone who's coming in tonight to listen live, and also for those who are going to or are listening to this now, archive. And once again, welcome Dr. Blahnik, and I'll get to the questions.
Okay,
first we will cover the two novels. And the first question is, you've written, as I said, the two novels, The Queen of Spades and Denial, A Tale of Love, Sex, and Modern Day Madness.
Right.
So let's discuss the Queen of Spades first, and can you tell us basically what the novel's about?
Yeah. It's about a retiring professor of literature in a Midwestern university. His name is Nicholas Baranski. He's from a Polish extraction here. He's been a professor for quite a while, 20-plus years, and he's into early retirement, thinking about early retirement, because he's kind of like burnt out. He's become very cynical. His marital life and his life with females has pretty much made him cynical as far as, you know, what he can do as far as relationships go. So he's decided to retire, and because he's been looking at his students now kind of like through that cynical eye too, and he's kind of like taking a negative view of his students. And so he's catching himself on this and says, okay, I've got to do something about this. I can't be doing this as far as treating my students this way, having this bad attitude in life. So he decides to take early retirement. And he's been a professor of literature now, but he's never been able to write a novel. He's been doing a lot of work as far as essays. He writes essays. He's known for his essays. So he's pretty well stayed close to the vest, because he never really wanted to go on beyond his essay writing. But he's tried a few novels during the time that he was tenured there at the university. And they didn't go anywhere, so he never really finished. So he decided to, well, this time he's going to put it together and do it. And he sits down and thinks up something here, and he says, since he's so cynical about things and so negative, he wants to recover something of his lost past. And he harkens back then to a time when he felt like that he had a good attitude to life. And he always felt that he was kind of like a romantic type of an individual, but he had the romance kind of kicked out of him as time went on. So he thinks back about his grade school sweetheart. And so he's going way back. And he says, okay, well, he's going to write a novel about his grade school sweetheart, but he's not sure exactly how to go about it. And since he hasn't had any, you know, a lot of success as far as actually getting something out of his head, he decides to write short little vignettes. The vignettes now are going to be something dealing with his past, but he doesn't know exactly how this is going to happen. So he writes in little spurts. These vignettes then are a story-like structure. But they're like a patchwork, kind of like a quilt. He writes little bits and pieces about his grade school time in a little patchwork and a little quilt, and he tries to put it together here. And this is about his and he centers it on his grade school sweetheart here. And so he entitles his book The Queen of Spades.
And why The Queen of Spades? For the title.
Yes. Right, the Queen of Spades is a game that there was a game in the 50s and the 60s that was called Spades. Okay, not the spades that you know and that you regularly play. This was kind of like a bit of an underground game, at least an underground game as far as boys were concerned, because this is not considered really a masculine type of a game. This is more of a feminine type of a game, if you will. So it's a romantic type of a game. And how the game is played is that you have however many guys are involved in this, and they're probably doing it clandestinely, you know, like off to the side so that nobody can see them. And in this case, they were doing it on the playground. So they would bring a deck of cards to school with them and do it on the playground. And they would take the four queens out of the deck, and then they'd lay them face up. And then the idea of the game is to be able to match two of the queens, like the red queens, with two of the girls that you didn't like. And two of the queens, like the black queens, with two of the girls that you did like. So whoever was dealing this out here, they'd put the four queens down on the floor, on the ground there, and then the person who was playing the game would have to assign the names to those queens. So the character here, who now, okay, the character's name is Victor Zorinsky. But the character who is writing the novel here in vignettes is Nicholas Baranski. Okay, so Nicholas Baranski created his character, Victor Zorinsky, which was partially based on himself. And the Victor Zorinsky then was the character who was assigning these names. And so what he would do then is assign the two girls that he didn't like to the red queens and the two girls that he did like to the black queens. And the girl that he liked the most was Carol Lochek. And this girl then he would assign to the Queen of Spades. So what would happen then is that the person who was doing the dealing here, the card dealing, to make it a romantic type of a thing, and supposedly then to build up drama, okay, which was they'd flip over a card. He would say something before he flipped over a card. He would say, this is the first girl that you're going to kiss. And then he'd turn over the card and see which one it matched up to. So if it matched up to somebody that he didn't like, then, you know, you'd make some kind of face or something. And if it matched up to somebody he did like, then you would get embarrassed or smile or whatever the response was. And then you keep building the tension here in flipping over the cards until you finally get to the final card. And the final card now was already pre-selected, and nobody looked at the final card. Nobody. So that final card was hidden. So the final card then, keeping it in the romantic line here, is that's the one that you're going to marry. And so he would always hope for Carol Lochek, okay, the Queen of Spades. And in 12 times out of 12 that they had done this, it worked out that way. He got the Queen of Spades. So that is the reason for the story, the reason for the title, anyway.
Because a lot of the book is, I guess, about him and about his childhood and things of that nature. And so it's a novel within a novel, you would say.
Yeah, it's a novel within a novel. So there's Nicholas Baranski is the retiring professor who writes a book about some of his experiences and a lot of fiction involved in it, but he writes drawing on his past experiences here of his grade school and his grade school sweetheart. And he creates the character Victor Zorinsky, which is actually him. Okay, and so it's and I, of course, created the character of Nicholas Baranski, who creates the character of Victor Zorinsky. So it's a novel within the novel, and made up of these short vignettes. But between the vignettes, in front of the vignettes, and after the vignettes, you have Nicholas Baranski in his actual up-to-date life. So what's going on in his up-to-date life then? He lets the people know, you know, what's happening as he's retiring, and he has a friend that he meets in the cafe, and they discuss things. His friend is a teacher also at the university, and they just jabber about stuff. And he's still working at the university, his friend is. And then they compare notes, how their lives are going. And it's a way of tapping somebody and of expressing himself to somebody then in his retirement. And then and they have a little bit of a competition going through these two guys here, a little bit of a competition. So he gets derided and derailed about making an attempt to write another novel because his friend knows that he has failed on the novels before. So he tries to do it again, and so he's kind of making fun of him and helping him along at the same time. But that's the beginning of the the vignettes, and in interspersed in the middle of these vignettes to Nicholas Baranski's life is unfolding. So it's like a novel, what's happening to Nicholas Baranski as his life is unfolding, and what happens to his character's life, and they both kind of intersect.
Okay, so when it says he's in competition, of a sense, with one of the other characters, just for a little background, I'm not trying to do a spoiler, but what is the reasoning behind the competition?
It's just a friendly competition. It's something like the friend also wanted to write a novel, and the friend was in a similar boat, okay, as Baranski. So his friend was he envies Baranski to some degree for being able to write such good essays, but his writing, his friend's writing, though a little more creative, he's not a very successful type individual. He hasn't succeeded a whole lot. He's had enough. He's had enough success, you know, to make his creative life worthwhile there. But they both have success as far as being professors at the university, so they will kind of like jibe each other and write each other and see if anybody can write a novel, you know, that something that both of them have always wanted to do. But his friend holds off on writing novels anyway. Okay, he questions some of his talent, questions some of his ability.
Okay, so I've interviewed some other authors before, and one of them they had where the protagonist was actually a female. And I know in this story the protagonist is a male, but some of the interactions that took place really were appealed to women. So that just brings me to a question that, you know, I've been asking other authors, is there anything within these stories that would appeal to both men and women?
Yeah, I think the romantic nature of the novel, well, of the people I know and the responses that I've had since the book came out, women tend to like it a lot. Men have liked it too, but for different reasons. I think the women like it because of the romantic story involved. It is a very romantic kind of touching type of novel. Nicholas Baranski's past and his not really an unrequited type of love, but he always felt that he had some kind of love for this grade school girl, but he didn't quite know what that love entailed. And the relationship does last for a while. It lasts longer than one would think of a traditional grade school type of a situation, especially because in this book he moves. He goes from the Midwest where he went to school, went to a Catholic school, out west to California, where he goes to a public school. So in answer to your question, I'd say that as this novel develops, and because of its romantic quality and because there is a meshing of the lives in here, a meshing of the Nicholas Baranski's life and Victor Sirinsky's life, his character, and there's a meshing of those two lives, and that has a very romantic touch to it, a very romantic quality. So I think women would really like the book. Men, I think, though, would like the book for different reasons. I think men can identify. First off, it's the protagonist is a male. They can identify, and if you come from a, let's say, a Catholic tradition, especially because the boy was Catholic, you come from a Catholic tradition, you can pretty well identify with what's going on, especially if you had some connection to the 50s and the 60s Catholicism, a little more rigid than today's Catholicism, but the overlap is still there. The Catholic tradition is still there. So I think men and women could identify with the Catholic tradition and the Catholic background. Though I think men have had a certain closer connection with the Catholic tradition than have women. Completely spurious type of comment there without any kind of empirical background to support that. But in the book, though, the character in the book is in sports. So he plays basketball and plays baseball. Okay, and there are vignettes that deal with the basketball and baseball that people would identify with, that guys would identify with. And just the fact that he's a guy, too, and the sexual stuff, too. There's when he makes his move to the West, to California, he starts, that's when he's around 12, so a lot of sexual things start to happen at that point there, from the positive side and from the negative side. So in the sexual side, then guys will be able to identify with that. I think they'd be able to appreciate some of the things that this kid goes through. So it's kind of like a coming-of-age novel within another novel, a coming-of-age novel within another novel.
Okay, now, and I ask this of either the authors or I have had singers come on or lyricists come on the show as well. And what did you, and then we'll move on to the other book, is what did you draw from when writing the book, The Queen of Spades?
What did I draw from?
Yeah, what did you draw from?
Draw from some experience of, well, I kind of like go with the motto. I guess it's kind of like a truism by now that a writer should write what he knows. I believe that so. You should write what you know. That doesn't mean necessarily that you should write your life story or anything like that, but you draw from areas where you're familiar. And my own background, too, was one of a Catholic tradition, so I'm familiar with that whole tradition, and I know what this kid's going through. And so I draw from that religious tradition. I drew a lot from that religious tradition. And also some experiences, too, because I've lived out in California, and a certain section of California anyway, and I was able to pull that section out and capture it, because I've always had a particular feeling in relation to California versus Midwest. There's also a connection there because, right now, I teach in the Midwest, and when I was a kid, too, I lived in the Midwest. So the both connections there are those are the two things that I pull from mainly.
Okay, well, on to the next book, and then one thing I'd like to do tonight is after we talk about denial, I have here in your biography that you've published four original works in philosophy when developing your new philosophical perspective, and also about the plays. We don't have to go in those at length. I mean, I would like to go into experientialism if we have the time at length, and also about we talked earlier about the Associated Independent Dramatic Arts, if we have time to cover all that. And also, there's something else I wanted to cover if we have time, but we'll see. And then, of course, if anyone has any questions, they can either call in at 347-945-7428 and ask some questions, or they can just ask it in the chat, and I'll convey it to Dr. Blahnik here.
I'll tell you what, if you want to talk about the experientialism and philosophy and the association, then that'll take up a little bit. I know if you want to go right to that, that would be okay. You could skip the other novel if you want to go right to that, because that'll take a little while, maybe we'll go over your showtime or whatever.
Okay, it's a 2-hour show. I think we have a good amount of time, so we can move into the second novel, and then we can move from there, because one of the things. The reason I have the authors and whoever on is to promote their works. So let's do that portion, and then of course move on to the other things as time permits.
Okay.
So what I've got here is the book is called Denial, and it's called A Tale of Love, Sex, and Modern Day Badness. And that's, as you can guess, a pretty provocative title. So if you can give us some, you know, background on that. And, I mean, if, is it the content, I'm guessing, of the story? But
sure,
if you could tell us about that.
Sure, yeah. It's, again, it's going to be a professor here. There, again, I'm drawing from experience. And you can pick professor as characters here, and I can know what I'm talking about a little bit better. This is a middle-aged professor, though. This one teaches philosophy. And he's married. He has a couple of kids. But he finds himself in a unusual position. And this is kind of like a position that brings up some philosophical and psychological issues. He's always been the type of person who, let's say, ever since he was young, able to feel kind of deeply in relation to other people. So it'd be like children or older people, men, women. It didn't really matter. He had this ability.
And it's empathic-like, or?
Yeah, what?
And it's like an empathy of sorts?
Yeah. Well, no. Not like an empathy, but the empathy would be a part of it. So
okay.
It would be like, it would be more, instead of empathy, it would be more like affection. You would feel a certain closeness, okay, to people, especially certain types of people, people who were kind of, or seemed kind of vulnerable, people who had had a kind of like a built-in vulnerability to them. And he responded to these types of people, whether they were children, whether they were males or, you know, men or women, it didn't really matter. He had this kind of an ability here. And he didn't keep himself from expressing that ability either. He had a tendency to be forthright with it, straightforward with it. And he didn't have any difficulty with this ability, okay, until he was married, and then he started feeling some of these feelings of affection then for women other than his wife. Now
Uh-oh.
the problem really started. So now this guy is, now he's feeling these feelings, okay, toward women other than his wife, at least a few of them here. And it worked out okay in the sense that his wife, okay, knows that of this. His wife, of course, you know, knows that he has this ability, and he expresses it. And so, but when he starts expressing it towards other females, she begins to wonder. But she thinks, okay,
real quick, Dr. Blatt, I apologize for interrupting. Someone said they may be having some sound problems. I don't know if it's on your end or the end here. If maybe there's a way you can speak a little more gladly for them, or maybe they just need to refresh the page. So why don't we try both folks and see where that brings us.
Okay, speak a little more loudly.
Yeah, I think so. She says she has no sound, but, I mean, it could be something. Oh, yep, she refreshed. She refreshed. But, yes, I'm also, yeah, if you could speak a little louder, too, for the folks. Or at least for me,
okay.
They could turn up the volume on their computers. I can't do that as much on the phone that I'm on. So, but, yeah, she can hear now. Thank you. Thank you, Tessa. That's someone who's in the audience in the chat. You made the comments. Go ahead. Apologize for interrupting.
No, that's okay. Okay. Well, let me know. Interrupt again if I'm not being heard here, okay?
Okay, great.
Okay. So, like I said, with this ability that he has here, now he starts feeling these feelings toward several other women. And his wife at first doesn't have any really serious problems with this. She thinks that he can handle the situation, and it's not really threatening to her. But when it happens with the wife, his wife's cousin, that it turns everything upside down. Okay, and the novel is basically capturing what happens, the aftermath, the
hell breaking loose.
The hell that breaks loose. Yeah, the hell that breaks loose after the aftermath here. This is a threatening thing. Okay, and his wife then makes a 180 degree turn. And she no longer looks at these expressions of affections as legitimate. They're really something illegitimate, and that she feels like she's been duped, okay, and that he is suffering from some kind of a chemical imbalance. And she is stuck in the position now of thinking of divorce. But she's not sure of how to go about it because he really hasn't done anything in the sense of actually done anything. But he has feelings that she considers wrong, that they're not only wrong, but that he is psychologically imbalanced. So then it's a matter of what happens after that. And the development here, without getting into too many of the details here, the development here is that in pressing the issue, she wants to make his situation such that she can feel justified in getting the divorce. And so she presses the issue that he is crazy. Or some kind of a chemical imbalance. She doesn't know how to deal with it. So she presses that issue. And then she brings her family and her friends into the situation to support her. And also the cousin, too. Her cousin, who denies any kind of feelings at all. That any kind of contact that they have had in the past, that is the protagonist here. Joseph Volk is the name of the protagonist here, and his wife's cousin. Any contact that they've had in the past, she denies, the cousin that is, denies any kind of feelings that ever come out of that. And he, on the other hand, Joseph Volk, is maintaining that she has had feelings like that, and that basically that she is one of those vulnerable individuals, feels that, you know, she's a vulnerable individual who has, in a sense, opened herself up to him, and he has responded. And he denies any kind of wish or will to have any kind of a romantic relationship with her, but this doesn't work with the wife, okay? His wife says, she's not going to buy any of it, and that he needs to get some kind of mental help. So that's the madness portion.
And speaking of that, I'm sorry, go ahead. Okay, yeah, and speaking of that, during my research of this particular novel, I see that it has some psychological, social, and now we normally don't touch political stuff on Wednesdays, but I tell the audience in a disclaimer every time that sometimes politics will creep in, and I know there's not a lot of that in the book, but there are, as I said, psychological, social, and political aspects that can be found in the book, correct?
Yeah, mostly psychological and social issues. The political and the social kind of run together, I'd say, in this. Because you got the question, and philosophical also. You have the psychological / philosophical question: can a man or a woman? Okay, it doesn't really matter. It could be a man. Can they feel affection, some kind of a love, for someone of the opposite sex, other than their spouse, without that affection being experienced as threatening? Is it an automatic setup in our culture that if a man or a woman expresses these kinds of feelings towards somebody of the opposite sex, is it automatically going to be a threatening type of experience? And we experience kind of like as a dichotomy, like it's an either-or situation. Like either you have affection for a wife or husband, okay, or you have affection for somebody else. You can't have both. That is, you can't have affection for both. As you know, in our culture, there's no problem with having sexual relations with more than one individual. Sexual relations, men have for centuries have had sexual relations. Women are gaining ground on this score here, too, to have sexual relations with somebody other than their spouse. But that's not the issue here. The issue is not it's not sexual in that sense. It's emotional. It's an emotional issue. Can you have these feelings of affection for somebody and without that being threatening? And for many people, it seems it's that is the most threatening. That is the most threatening area to a man or a woman. But the argument here, I guess, with the evolutionary theory would say that men tend to be more threatened by the female or the wife having sex with some other male, whereas the female is supposed to be more afraid of the man loving another female or wanting to leave for another female, because the loving usually means leaving. And that's the dichotomous question here, the psychological question, the philosophical question raised, is that is it an either-or situation? Is it a both-and situation? Is it, if it's an either-or situation, then is this character here deluded? Is he deluding himself into thinking that this is possible? It is possible to feel affection towards somebody other than your wife and vice versa with the wife. Is he deluding himself? Or, you know, is this an actual reality that people need to look at and need to face? Same thing with the wife on the other end of the spectrum. So that's the psychological side of it and the philosophical part. Poses a social question, too. If you can't deal feelings, these kinds of feelings from multiple people, then why don't we have a way of understanding these kinds of feelings without exploding marriages? Can feelings like this be brought into a marital situation without being threatening? And we don't seem to have any words for that kind of a thing where somebody would have these feelings for somebody else. You don't have a word that fits that particular situation. So if we don't have a word that fits that situation, is it something that we consider just too threatening? And that's part of the dichotomy here. The dichotomy says it's an either-or situation here. It's not a both-and, so you don't need a word for it. So if this character here has feelings of affection for another woman, then it's like automatic. He's supposed to be with this other woman and leave the wife. That's the reasoning then behind the fear in the situation, behind the threat. But if it didn't involve leaving, if the feelings of affection then didn't involve leaving, would the other person be threatened? That's a social question. The political question, like I said, overlaps with the social question, and that dealt with the mental health profession here in the book. Because the mental health profession is kind of like attacked in a way or exposed in a way as imposing its particular point of view on this kind of quasi-moral situation here. Is this a moral situation, a biological situation, or what? And the mental health profession then in the book takes a particular stand on it here that confirms, goes along with the protagonist's wife, in this instance here, saying that that this is kind of an impossible type of a situation, and it reflects back then on the protagonist and making the protagonist seem crazy or look crazy to them and the world. So the mental health profession then backs the protagonist's wife. So the question then is the upshot of it is here, you can look at it, I guess, from two different points of view. You can look at, is this novel an attack on the political aspect of the mental health profession and an attack on society in the sense of saying that this dichotomous relationship is something that is kind of antiquated, should move on to other things that would not be considered threatening, and that words should come up for types of relationships like this, feelings like this, without exploding marriages. Or is this character delusional? Is this character rationalizing so much of his past and his abilities? As you call them, abilities. Is he rationalize all of these things? And he really should be in some kind of institution or in, you know, a psych ward. And it all deals with this idea then of forbidden love. Forbidden love in the sense of not a romantic relationship type love, but of a different sort, I guess, a love that goes along with a certain vulnerability. Or is he crazy? You can look at it from two different points of view.
Okay, well, the next question I have here is, and then we, after this question, we'll move on to the other things we talked about. And if anyone would like to call in or, you know, or maybe ask a question in the chat.
Okay.
The call-in number, and that is either about the books or maybe some of the other things we're getting ready to cover, at 347-945-7248. I'm sorry. There you go, 347-945-7428. And we're welcome to do that. So the last question here before we move into some of the other things, you know, about the novel specifically, the last question for the novel specifically, I should say, is, or novels, is, do you find any inspiration for your novels from your own life, and we touched this earlier, and from your own experiences, or do you, you know?
Like I said, it's the old adage that says that you write what you know, and there's a good deal of truth to that, and that doesn't mean you write your life story or anything like that, but you write from areas that you know, that you're familiar with. So, like I mentioned, the professorial thing. The novel that I'm writing right now deals with a psychologist, okay, and that's another area of which I'm familiar. So I'm familiar with these types of areas, and I have backgrounds in these types of areas, so I'll draw from them. And but another way of looking at it, I guess, is a writer can take an incident or an event in their life or a person, some kind of, and it could be just as simple, something as simple as that, and then it's something that is of a passionate nature for that person, and use that as a kernel and build a fictional world around it. And that fictional world then can inform that situation. It's as if the fictional world pulls from that grounding, but that grounding would be in some kind of experience in life, some kind of life experience that the author has had. And same thing with the person. They could lock into a particular person, say, okay, that person is so impactful on the author's life that they want to develop a story around that person and create a fictional world around it. So that's another way of going about it. And the other way that I can draw from experience is that if I create a completely fictional surrounding world, even in a completely fictional surrounding world, I'll draw on people I know and people who have made an impact on me, events that might have happened in my life, and I'll pick those little bits and pieces and chop them up and use them in this fictional world, and that gives it a certain passion or grounding. It fuels that totally fictional creation there. But you're always seeming to pull something from life experiences to make it happen. Just a matter of degree, depending on what you're writing.
Okay. Anything else you want to touch on about either of the two novels? Perhaps, you know, let folks know where they can get them, things of that nature. or purchase them. What I'm getting ready to do now is I'm going to put a couple of links in the chat, and I know these are two of your websites, and you can also find these links for those who will be listening to this later on the archive on the description portion of the show on the Bard's Logic Political Talk homepage, and that also will take you there. Plus, for the next week, you'll also be able to find a link to Dr. Blahnik's pages through the website, the Bard's Logic Political Talk website, and you can find that on the featured guests, in which you'll have a link there. You'll find a link there from both of his websites and the link to the archive of this show tonight. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and put one of the links in the chat for the folks to look at. And then there's the first one, and then I'm going to put in the second one, and then Dr. Blahnik, if you'd like to tell people where they can, you know, besides your websites, perhaps where else they would be able to find your book.
Well, that would be the main one, to go right to that web, or to get it right off the website. You can go directly then to the printer distributor, subsidiary of Amazon.com. That would be the most direct way. You go right to it. But you can get it from Amazon, you can get it from Barnes & Noble, Borders, you know, any of the stores, any of the retail outlets.
Okay, great, awesome, definitely. And, you know, I have read most of the first book, the Queen of Spades, and then I'd definitely like to, you know, read more of the other book. Unfortunately, I didn't have enough to read it at in detail, but just enough where I could get some ideas for the interview tonight. But what I'd like to talk on now is the new philosophical perspective, in which I believe you call it experientialism. Am I correct in that?
Correct.
Okay, and if you could tell us, tell the audience, you know, more about what experientialism is, and then we can move on from there to on how you've applied that to psychotherapeutic theory and practice.
Yeah. Okay. In a nutshell. Okay, it's going to be much more involved than I'm, you know, able to.
Oh yes, definitely.
Say right now, but I'll give you the Reader's Digest version here. It's a philosophy that says something like quite simply and straightforwardly that experience is equal to reality if experience is defined as a necessary combination between certain elements, between cognition or thought, affect or feeling, behavior, sensation, all four or five of the sensory outlets there, and the environment. So you have to hook all of these five components together, and you can't separate these two. And that's the important part here, is that this is coming out of moving away from, it's actually doing both, coming out of and moving away from phenomenology, and it's phenomenology and existentialism. Because these two philosophies, especially now phenomenology, which existentialism is kind of like a part of phenomenology, is the overlapping category name, coming out of the phenomenology background, that would hold something to the effect that the mind or the mental or things of an inward nature are the most important things to look at, as opposed to empiricism, which would tend to hold, or realism, which would tend to hold that the outside world is more important than the inside world, than the mental world. But phenomenology pulls together the mental world and the material world, the outside world with the inside world, and says you've got to have them both. And experientialism agrees with this very fundamental type of an idea here, says that we are beings in the world, that we think of ourselves now and can think of ourselves and imagine ourselves as beings over and against the world. And that would be more of a scientific point of view or an empirical point of view, that we are being over and against the world and that we can understand that world from a detached position. So science has tried very hard to create circumstances whereby the scientist will detach himself from what he or she is investigating and come away with that study or whatever they're doing there in relation to whatever they're studying with the impression that they have, in a sense, captured the objective world. And the question is, have they captured the objective world? Now, the phenomenologist will say no, and the experientialist would also say no. Now, when you look at the elements in, or the components there, they're called components, making up experience, being cognition and affect and behavior, sensation, the environment. The environment is a component now of experience where traditional view of experience wouldn't include the environment as a necessary component. It would say that that environment is something separate from the rest. The rest is kind of like belonging to the person. So the person's mind being the cognition and the affect, and the person's behavior being body and motion, and then the person's sensation being all the five senses, all that belongs to the person. But the environment doesn't. The environment, at least looked at from a common sense or scientific point of view, the environment is separate. But when you look at the environment and say, okay, and pull it into the experiential structure, you pull it into that structure, then you got a different kind of a situation. Then the person, in this sense, becomes a part of experience and moves through time within that experiential structure. The question then arises, can you get outside of that experiential structure? Because we make all kinds of objective claims in life. You know, the theist will say that God exists and, you know, that God has created the world. The evolutionist will say, you know, that we evolved, you know, from primordial matter, these are objective claims. These are traditional objective claims. And we make all kinds of objective claims. But the question asked here from the experiential point of view, can we get outside of this experiential structure to prove or make good these claims? And if you say, okay, theist, can you get outside of that structure? And the theist will say, well, you know, I had an experience that made me believe that God exists and, you know, this type of thing. Well, the experience is going to be part of the experiential structure, that they're going to hook to another experiential structure being their claim that God exists. Or if they say, well, I read it in the Bible, and there's going to be another experiential structure that they're going to be participating in as they're reading the Bible there, and they're going to hook that one then to past experiences. Can you ever get outside of this experiential structure to make good your claim? And the experientialist contention this year is no. No, you're in the structure. So when you do make objective claims, traditional objective claims, you'd better own them. That is, they'd better be yours. And that's kind of like a more of a relativity type of a situation. Let's say it's not a relative type of philosophy, and I hesitate to get any further with it because then I'll be giving a whole seminar here. But I'll just leave it at that, okay? Say that the experiential view then would align in some ways with phenomenology and existentialism and kind of like go an essential step further.
Okay, well, it looks like we have someone here on the line on hold. So I will let them in, see if they have any comments or questions or anything of that nature. So it's called Think Medical. Is, I guess they're calling it on Skype or some other kind of software. So I do have just two rules when people call into the show. One, especially when they're calling in the guests, is be respectful. And if I see any hint of any disrespect toward any guests, then I will automatically just kick you from the show. And I've never really had too many problems with that, but I always do put that out. But also, of course, there's no profanity on the show, and so that's about the only two rules. So at this time, I'm going to open up the mic of the person that can ask their comment or question. So Here you go. Think Medical, your mic is live.
Hello, is it loud enough to hear?
Yes, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't really actually want to say anything, but I can do. I was just listening on the software. But I suppose I can ask a few questions. I was curious about how you go about accounting for scientific claims, then, about how you would really want to, to explain how science works, really. You know, scientists say that, if I shoot a gun, then the bullet goes through a pane of glass, and the glass will fracture in such and such a way. Are you the kind of person that says that somehow experience conspires to make it all work out, or how do you go about saying that kind of thing?
Real quick, Dr. Blanc, I'm just curious because I noticed the accent. Where are you calling from, or from the software? I'm just curious.
England. So
you're in England.
I'm British.
Great. Oh, well, thank you very much. Actually, because I must say, for the record, that you are the first person to call into the show from that area. So thank you very much for being the first one to call from Britain. I appreciate it. Thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Blanc, if you'd like to answer that.
As far as the scientific experience, so science, the experiences that scientists would say, from the experiential point of view, you kind of look at it like this. Scientists are going to experience the world like everybody else does. So they're going to be relative in that sense. The scientific experience and the artist's experience and whoever else's, the athlete's experience, all of these people, everybody, would be within an experiential structure. And to say that, a scientific experiences are a type, then, they would be viewed as a type of experiential structure, a very practical type in the sense that they'd have scientific experience would involve experiences that move what I would call from frame to frame, okay, frame to frame, experiential structure to experiential structure to experiential structure here, that would be connected to each other in the sense that they want to see what causes what. Okay, so the causal connection between within certain situations here, they want to be able to predict the future, and they want to be able to capture the sort of laws of the universe so they can predict and somewhat control the situation. So you have a group of experiences here that can control a very practical situation. We'll understand that if you shoot a bullet or something through the glass breaks. Experience will dictate that. Experience says, okay, when that happens, this is what. And so you come up with some kind of an explanation as to how that happens. And you can have all kinds of different explanations for it, and science is going to come up with its explanation for it. And it'll say, okay, if you view the world in this way, that you got a hard type of a pellet here, it has a certain type of force, and it comes into contact with something here, another type of object. Okay, another type of object, and they can move that object in a certain way, break it up, and it'll do it for these and these reasons. So science will come up with its own vocabulary. It'll come up with its own explanation as to how this happened. All that's fine. Experiential thinking or experiential the point of view here would incorporate that type of thinking. Where the line is drawn here, or the difference would be, is that the scientist has a tendency, or have a tendency, to slip beyond the experiential structure, or believe that he has gone past the experiential structure and has actually captured objective reality. And in capturing objective reality, then it gives him a type of power, and the type of power is that I can use this notion here, capturing this objective reality to, in a sense, if I have to, speaking like a scientist here, impose it on somebody else. That is what would be called in a more consistent way with a scientist. You would learn this, and the science wouldn't look at it as an imposition. They would look at it more as teaching. So that you would learn that, when you fire a pellet and it breaks, that this is why it does it. So all this learning would be put together, but you're really, from an experiential point of view, not moving beyond your experiential structure. Rather, you're participating in the experiential structure and making certain claims that you can show over and over again that have practical consequence. It's a good thing to listen. It's a good thing to listen to. It's a good thing to orient yourself around in some circumstances, some not. Okay? To orient yourself around because the outcomes will be good for you. So science or a scientific experience would have practical quality, but the experiential point of view then would incorporate that scientific experience under its kind of like the umbrella. Hope I answered your question.
So my impression is then that you're saying that really there's no... I'm not sure if you're saying this. Are you saying that there's no world that science describes that's apart from experience? Or are you saying really that we can't know that there's a world that science describes? Are you saying there isn't one, or are you saying there isn't one that we can know about?
Okay, the question, the way you put the question then, from the experiential point of view, it would just be altered a little bit. You wouldn't say, is there a world that science describes? Say, it would be viewed more as the scientist is inextricably involved with that quote-unquote world, okay, what I would call the environment then. They are inextricably involved with it. So even while they're doing studying that world, they are in that world. And to think that they have escaped that world simply by studying the world, that's going too far. And then they've crossed a certain line here saying, well, I've described the objective world, captured it as well as possible here. And in describing this objective world, then if you have a different point of view, then, you know, since I've captured the objective world and you're differing from my point of view, you're wrong. For them to say that or to go that far would be too far, unless they were to own their own claims. If they own their own objective claims, if they say, okay, evolution has brought about the world, and the earth here, and people in it. Okay, the evolution has brought that about. And I believe that if you believe differently, like if you believe in creation or something like that, that you're wrong. And if you put a period right at the end of that, if there is an implied for me after that period, kind of like in brackets, if there's a for me that is an ownership in relation to that objective claim, the experientialist wouldn't have any trouble with it. A lot of people will make, everybody makes objective claims if you have a for me at the end of it. But a lot of people don't put that for me at the end of it or have that implicit bracketed ownership. Rather, they'll say it as if this is the case. That is, from an experiential view, they'll be saying something that they have transcended their own experience, the experiences within which they participate. They have gone beyond and reached objective reality. And now with that power now, since they have been privy to objective reality, they can in turn it on other people. And if they had the power to do so, and maybe the weaponry, okay, they can do so. And they can convince others that this is the objective reality that they have to deal with, and they better do it. And that's too far. Okay, from the experiential point of view, a scientist would have gone too far in making objective claims without owning those claims.
So are you saying then that there isn't a shared reality that we can all agree upon, that there's sort of a divided reality that we, it's a kind of like there's many parallel worlds that we're all part of,
I think there are many things that we can agree on. We can agree on a lot of things, like in the physical world. You say, okay, this chair is shaped this way, this table is this long, this is moving in this direction. We can agree on a lot of things in the physical world, less so in the mental world, the mental world. We can get to inner experiences, and they have more. They can be a little more amorphous. So we have more difficulty agreeing on those inner experiences. But even those we can agree on. We can say, okay, that this person loves that person, and know what they're talking about, and then feel it themselves, if they felt it. But sometimes people don't feel it. If you don't feel that love, but you could see a table, but you don't feel the love, and then that inability to feel that love then is a little bit throws your world and says you put question marks around it and say, does it really exist? Okay, so there are a whole slew of things that we all agree on or that we can't agree on. And as you get further and further toward, you know, personal experiences, then we might agree less and less.
Okay, so I'm a little bit confused then. So what's the difference between, so let's say there were two people in a room and one person, say, had trouble with their eyesight and looking ahead of them and saw what they thought was a chair but may have been, say, a sofa or a beanbag or something. And I say to that person, no, that's a beanbag, and they say, oh, no, it's a chair. Now, if I say it's a chair and I could get more people in the room and more people agree with me that it is really a chair and they're confused about it, so what's different from me saying to them, no, you're wrong, it is a chair, and a scientist saying, for example, no, God didn't design human beings, evolution was responsible for that. Are you happy with the first kind of claim that I can say to someone who's virtual with their eyesight, this is really a chair, and are you unhappy that a scientist can say, no, you know, there's no blueprint for human beings, it's a consequence of evolution? Do you see those as two different kinds of claims?
Okay, I'm not quite understanding you. Can you kind of like rephrase? You're talking about a chair,
right? So
and then you're talking about evolution. I'm not sure how the connection.
If I may chime in, gentlemen, is he talking about something subjectivism, or is he saying, is it more subjectivism or objectivism or something of that nature?
I'm kind of interested to see whether or not this experientialism is really relativism or whether it's not. So if there's two people, you talk about a table, for example, people can agree that there's a table in front of them. But what do you do if one person doesn't believe there's a table in front of them, perhaps because they've got poor eyesight? And if they don't agree there's a table in front of them, are we allowed to correct them? I mean, can we say, no, you're wrong? Because you seem to say that whenever we make claims about the world, we always have to make them relative to ourselves. But it seems that really we ought to be able to correct people and say, no, your eyesight's bad, there really is a table there.
Yeah, okay, that sounds good. Okay, can I take that as far as the table there or not there and make it a little less extravagant? And because it'll be kind of hard to show that, you know, the table not being there in the case of the person can touch it and all that. So let's say if you use a color situation and you say that the table that you're looking at, one person sees that table as red, okay? And another person sees it as some kind of a shade of gray. Okay, the shade of gray person, I'm saying this and it's, it just doesn't have to be the case, the actual case, as far as, you know, our experience goes, as far as colorblind people. But let's say a colorblind person sees the table as gray, some type of gray, maybe a light gray or something like that. And it's like the person who sees it as red would argue with that person and say, no, I'm going to correct you on this score here. This is really a red table. And the person who sees it as light gray sees it as light gray. And they said, no, well, I would like to correct you on that. It's light gray. And then they show them other things that are red and gray, and they agree. It's the same thing down the line, very consistent on both sides. And then the question is, okay, is there an objective reality here, the question that you're putting here, that there's one reality, okay, if there's one reality beyond these two, okay, beyond these two, is that are either of these people able to get past their reality to the one reality? Or would it be a matter of the red person saying, hey, there are a whole bunch of people who agree with me, okay, all the other red people here see that they see this table as red, and we outnumber you guys because there's not too many of you, okay, the colorblind people. So we see this as red, you see it as light gray. Well, we're going to think you're wrong, but then you're talking just a matter of numbers. You're talking these guys have, and if they group together and assume that their experience is equal to objective reality without owning their own assumption and allowing some legitimacy to the light gray experiencing person, they don't allow that legitimacy, and they say, no, there's only one world, and because there's only one world, and we have it here, so if we have it, you must be wrong. So they would lay claim to an objective reality. The experientialist would say, too far. Okay, too far. They've gone beyond. Okay, they've in a sense, made or created an objective reality. They've grabbed onto something that they believe is theirs. And it's not only theirs, it is this late grade person's too. If the late grade person could, let's say, go fix the cone situation in his eyeball, they'd be able to see it too because it's there and it's red. And the experientialist would say, no, you don't get beyond your experiential structure to find out what that objective world is. You're always in the structure. Though you can make objective claims, and you can believe that you can get beyond and that you've captured it, and there's where the danger would come from here from an experiential point of view. You've gone too far. You can correct somebody in the sense of saying, the stick in this water here is actually straight, okay, versus crooked, even though it looks crooked. And then they go, well, no, it looks crooked to me. And then you could pull the stick out and say, okay, see this now? And it's okay. And then the other person will go, yeah, it is a straight stick. Okay, put it back in the water there. Put it back in the water, and then it's crooked again. And say, man, it looks crooked. It looks crooked, but there must be reasons for why it looks crooked, but it's straight when you pull it out. So in the air, when I look at it, it's straight. In the water, it looks crooked. So we have to figure out some kind of a reason for why this happens. And then they could come to some kind of determination, which science nicely provides, and says, here's why this would happen. And say, okay, well, I can accept that. Is this the way it really is? Who knows? Who knows? We can't get beyond our experiential structure to find out the way it really is. We're always in the structure itself. So if the scientific explanation works, and the other person says, yeah, I agree with that, my experience is my experience that opposed that. Okay, my experience opposed that, says that that's so. Whereas the light gray person and the red person there, the color blind and the color seeing person here, not being able to escape their situation, and you can't pull the, if you don't pull, you know, add cones or subtract cones or whatever needs to be done there from a scientific point of view, then you're not going to have that situation. You won't have the stick coming out of the water going, oh, I have a different experience in relation to that table. You're going to have a light gray person being consistently light gray, light gray, light gray, light gray, all the way down the line. In which case, then, the person who sees red is going to have to accommodate. They're going to have to accommodate that light gray person so that they don't, and that they respect that person's experiential structure here, the experiential structure, their reality, and respect that reality, and then make a world that accommodates them, that is, and that doesn't oppress them. Because the world isn't red, per se. It is for the bunch of people, but it's light gray for a little bunch of people. And so that the red-seeing person then would have to, if they're in charge, let's say, of doing things in the world, there are more of them, and they're making decisions that are going to affect the light gray-seeing person, that they would have to make decisions then to accommodate that world. Make sense?
I agree. It seems reasonable to say that about color. It seems that pretty much everyone agrees already about color and about sort of what you might call subjective quality of experience. So, it's not as though if a person felt pain instead of pleasure, or if they felt burning instead of coldness when they were out in the cold, that we would accuse them of trying to trick us or anything. We would just say that there was something wrong with their bodies, or that they had a different kind of physiology, if you like.
Okay.
I don't think we would impose anything on them, but there does seem to be certain kinds of things that we don't need people's agreement on for them to function properly. So, a scientist could have a model of how something works, so about how water freezes. So, for example, about the temperature of water and what temperature it sort of boils and things at different altitudes. And they could say, well, at sea level it boils at 100 degrees Celsius, and at top of Mount Everest it boils at 70 degrees Celsius, or wherever it would be. Now, it seems to me that, you could have a set of experiences. So you could be at the top of Mount Everest and trying to boil water, and you could come and find that it was slightly wrong or slightly inaccurate, or you weren't doing something properly. but it seems only fair that the scientists would say that you're doing something wrong in that situation, that if you're trying to boil water and it's not boiling properly, that you're doing something wrong. In other words, that there are certain kinds of facts about the world, it seems, that we don't require agreement on, that are simply are true or false, regardless of what people believe or experience. So if you were to experience, some kind of image in the sky or something, and it looked to you like a spaceship of some kind, and then we actually went up there and found out, no, it was a cloud or it was a bird or something, it would only seem reasonable to say to you, if you continue to insist it was a spaceship, even though we've got photographs and all kinds of things saying, look, it was a cloud, that you're doing something wrong to insist it was a spaceship, that you're being in some way unjustified or unreasonable. And it seems to me that in the framework that you're proposing, we can't really say of many people in many situations that they're being unreasonable or unjustified. We only have to say that we'll just let them get on with it. And it seems to me that that does a disservice to them as well as to ourselves.
Uh-huh. Okay, can I use an... sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm finished that. I mean, that was the question I was asking. The question I was asking is, are you being too accommodating? I mean, to be as accommodating as you seem to be would to do a disservice to certain people, because we would allow them to persist in mistaken beliefs that could easily be corrected if they would merely if they would recognize the degree of objectivity to the kind of things that we were discussing.
Real quick, gentlemen, and before you answer, Dr. Blahnik, I just want to add, there's another person online, not online, but on the line called Sleepy Salsa. If you're still out there and you'd like to call back in, feel free to go ahead and do so. You can go ahead, Gary, if you'd like to respond. Hello.
Hello? I didn't hear the last part.
I apologize. Yeah, there was some an echo. If someone's on a speakerphone, if they can move that away from the phone, we're getting an awful bad reverb. So, there you go. Well, no, I'm still there. Is anyone on with either of you two gentlemen on a speakerphone, or have your speakers up to the mic?
A tiny bit. I can try and turn it down a bit. Let's have a look.
Okay, it's only when I'm speaking, I guess, is when it's coming through. There was a person in the chat called Sleepy Salsa was the name of the person. They did call in, and if they'd like to call back and ask a question, then feel free to do so. But at this time, I will bring it back to Dr. Blahnik and see how he, or ask me if he wants to go ahead and answer that, and then we'll go on from there.
Okay, I had a couple of different things to say in relation to what you said there. That there is a certain reasonableness. If you hook reasonableness to experience in the sense of saying that the scientist is going to experience the world in a certain way, and they can repeat that experience over and over again, for them to say that it is reasonable to assume that this is so, that what they're saying is the case, so that if another person comes into the situation, who, let's say, doesn't have to have that much scientific training or anything like that, in any kind of words, the language, but they're able to affirm just through their senses that this is so. So if it's a bird or if it's a, if this person then were able to go up like the scientist does and look at this thing and see it as a bird, and then the odds are pretty good that this person will agree with the scientists that it's not really a UFO, it's a bird. And they had a particular way of looking at it. Now, if they maintain consistently that this is a bird, then the scientists will look at this experience and go, well, something's different about this guy. Okay, what is different about this guy? Is there anything legitimate here, or is there something going on underneath this person? Now, this what I'm going to say here, and I'm not going to actually say it, because it would require too lengthy of an explanation. Okay, so I'll just say that there is an objectivity within an experiential structure. That is, the experiential structure will have objective qualities. but it's within the structure itself that objectivity will lay, not outside. With that, and I know it's going to be unhelpful in that regard, but I'll just have to leave it at that because it requires too much to get into to see the objective components there. So all I'd say in relation to that is say that the scientist would not be able to remove himself from his own experiential structure, whatever he's looking at, and he'd say, okay, well, it's not a UFO, and we've gone up there and looked at it. Well, but he's experiencing something. He might have thought at the beginning, is this a UFO? So his experiential structure would be one of questioning whether or not we've got a UFO here or not. But then he's able to get up there and take a look at it or looks at it through a telescope or whatever and says, oh, okay, it's not a UFO at all, it's a particular type of bird, and you can have other people confirm that. All of that's experience. So to say, though, that now is this a relative theory, and I think that's the question that you're asking here, is this merely a relative theory? What anybody says goes is, whatever they say is, just because they say it. No, it's not a simple matter of anything they say, and it's not a relative theory that I'm talking about here, but it's going to be an unsatisfying answer because I can't tell you how the objectivity plays in because it would be too lengthy of an explanation. So I'm sorry that I can't do that.
Well, if I may, I mean, I assume by objectivity you mean, well, at least I would guess you mean something like that there is an extended structure to experience which is available to us all, so that, you know, there are laws and formula and there's a set relationships between object, spatial and temporal and so on, and that's an experience that can be investigated.
No, there you're talking like a scientist. No, it wouldn't be the same way, but it would be a different type of objectivity altogether. Okay, and again, I won't be able to describe it, but it would do away with that assumption of the one world that is reachable, that is understandable, that is graspable. And it would substitute for that particular view a type of objectivity within the experiential structure, within each person's experiential structure and how they operate. There would be a different type of objectivity. And that objectivity then would deal with the structure itself and not with this third world, this objective world.
Okay,
as dissatisfying as that is.
Let me ask about a slightly different question then. So talking about history, how do you account for people talking about historical events then, things which are not part of the current experiential structure as you describe it?
About
that.
All people then, let's say, are if they're within these experiential structures, like the contention is here, then they write down some things that have happened, okay, that to them, you know, in history, so people, they record events or whatever. All that's a part of an experiential structure, too. They put it in books, and all that is going to be a ton of experiences within that book. Okay, so they're going to take those experiences then, they're in book form now, and they're passed on from generation to generation, and they're giving their stories to the next people up. So the next people up are looking at that, and they're experiencing how they're experiencing their experiences. So history then is going to be then a compilation of experiential structures throughout time. And you connect back to them and say, okay, well, this is the case. Now, you don't have to accept it. You don't have to accept it as legitimate, that this is experiential structures that are going to reflect, a legitimate revelation of what they experience to be so. Maybe it's a fraud in the sense that they're creating a work of fiction here, but they're passing it off as a work of nonfiction. Okay, within an experiential world, the work of fiction and the work of nonfiction here are both going to be subject to experiential structures. They're both going to be a part of experiential structures. So it really doesn't matter whether you're talking fiction or nonfiction in that regard. Then you're talking about how the person, the current person, let's say, contemporary person, will accept that story, okay, that history. Like, did Lincoln really exist? Well, we have a whole bunch of people thinking that Lincoln really did exist, you know, believing that he exists. We have accounts, we have this, we have that, we have that. And we have little reason to really doubt, okay, that he existed. So we accept it. We accept it as so. Does it mean that it is so? No, not necessarily. It could have been one of the biggest fraud perpetrated on, you know, humanity. But we accept it as so, so we act accordingly. If we find out differently, you know, we'd be probably pretty shocked that, you know, that would be the case. So a lot of the experiential world is based on trust. So we're trusting each other, because if we're subject to our own experiential structures, if we're in those experiential structures and we accept somebody else's claim that their experience is such and it's different from our experience, we're going to have to accept that, or we may have to accept that, we might not. Okay, but we accept it on trust that that's so, and their world becomes a part of ours. I've never been to England. Okay? I've never been there, but I believe it exists. There's a lot of people saying that it exists. I act like it exists. I see it on globes. I see it on maps. You know, so everything around me says that it exists. So I accept it as so. So it's the same thing with history.
Okay. Then let me ask, say the reverse question, because I think the reverse question is more is where I was getting at. So, you know, if I have a certain goal, let's say I want to, let's say I'm dehydrated and I want to quench my thirst. Now, I can either, you know, eat some cake, or I can drink some water or something. But like, if I drink water, I know I'm going to quench my thirst. And it seems that, you know, most of the things we do are directed towards the future in some sense, that there's a set of goals that we have and we want to accomplish them. How do you account for... if there isn't an objective reality as such, but if we're all kind of just dealing and coping with our experiences and trying to, use them to try and navigate the world a bit, how do you account for the success of predictions and so on? So, you know, if I drink some water, I will quench my thirst, and if I throw a baseball, it'll go in an arc, and if I, you know, and the sun will come up tomorrow, and the, you know,
right,
night will follow day. I mean, how do you account for the continuing, you know, the predictable changing of experiences? If there's nothing causing experiences
right
to change that are not in experiences, how do you
right
account for their changing predictably?
Well, most of the time, then, the accounting would be something along like these lines here. We experienced it to be so. That is, somebody actually drank water and felt, you know, the better. Okay, so somebody actually experienced that situation. They made some conclusions then in relation to that situation, which would be another experience. And say, okay, well, I think when I do this, drink water, okay, when I drink water, I feel better. So then they have to come up with the idea of dehydration later on. They say, okay, so every time I do that, I feel better about things. So this seems to be a causal connection here. Well, some people, it might not work that way. You know, and they say, well, how come it didn't work that way with you? Then you go into investigating other ways, you know, that it didn't work. What I'm saying here is that it's practical, okay, that scientific experience then would be practical in the sense that we've actually had it, we've actually have this experience, we're part of the experience, and we make connections. All that has practical consequences. To be able to predict the future to some degree here has practical consequences. We can, in a sense, control the world a little bit, and we won't die that young. Okay? The world can get pretty crushing. So we learn things within the world through these experiences then, but it's through the experiences that the world comes, in a sense, to us. And if we don't get beyond that structure to that objective world. So we can predict? Yeah, we can predict. Based on what? Based on experience. Not the fact that there is an objective world that somebody has grasped.
Yes, but how do you account for the success of those predictions, though? I mean, it could be that tomorrow the sun won't rise, or that tomorrow
that,
if I shoot someone they won't die, or, you know, everything we know about the past doesn't necessarily determine the truth of those claims in the future. A scientist might say, for example, that the reason a bullet will kill someone tomorrow is because, you know, independent of experiences, there really is a world, and there really are bullets, and there are really these objects, and these exist, and they continue to exist, and it doesn't matter what we experience, they'll always be there. But you don't really say any of that. You seem to say that there's only experiences.
Well, I would agree in the sense with, okay, this is going to be the bias here, with a what I'd call a good scientist. A good scientist would tend to be, the inductive thinking of a good scientist would say something like, okay, the sun will come up tomorrow because it has come up in the past all these times. Every time I drink water, this is what I feel. Okay, so I think the next time I drink water, that's what's going to happen. All of that would, the good scientist would say, simply because all of that's the case doesn't mean that that's going to be the case tomorrow. It doesn't mean that it's going to be the case. Could be completely wrong about this. It could be something else altogether going on here. Maybe this is a time period where this is going to have an effect. Water is going to have this effect at this time period in the evolution of the cosmos here of the world. It's having this effect now, but maybe later it won't. Maybe those properties will change. Experience is going to change. We're starting to drink water here. It's not having that effect. We go, oh, what's the deal here? Okay. So if our experience changes, then our world is going to shift with it. We have to then, we're going to try to accommodate that shift somehow, that change in experience. Does that mean that we've escaped experience into the outside world? No, not at all.
Well, I'm not. The thing fundamentally is I don't necessarily agree that just because we acquire knowledge and we learn through experiences and experiences alone, that we're not allowed to infer either logically through induction or deduction or what have you, that our experiences
right.
sort of relate to some external world. I don't think that just because the content of our experiences is what we use, that we can't
right.
reason about an external world.
Right.
It doesn't seem that just because we're kind of sealed in our experiences that we can't make inferences about something external to those experiences.
As long as, let's say, from the experiential point of view here that I'm espousing here, as long as the person accepts the ownership, that is, they own their own inference. So if you make an inference from certain experiences that you have and you infer that this is an objective world, you have to own that inference. In other words, the inference is part of the experiential structure. It doesn't get you outside of the structure. It's part of it. It's just that you're making a claim about some past experiences here. You're inferring something is the case because of these past experiences, but you haven't jumped out of the experiential structure. Your inference is a part of the structure. And if you accept that inference, whatever it is that you're inferring, is yours. That is, you own that inference. The experiential point of view has no problem with that whatsoever. It's once that disclaim, once you've cut that connection that says, well, it's not my experience that makes it so, it is so, then you've gone too far. Then it says that you've laid claim to objective reality. And since objective reality is one, everybody else who disagrees with you is automatically wrong. And when they put the person in that position, they have claimed to be objective reality. All you got to do is lump those people together and like-thinking people, and if they have people who disagree with them, the like-thinking people can oppress the other people and say, okay, your world is wrong. We're going to make you think like us.
It seems to me that the motivation for your point of view is what might be called moralistic fallacy of some kind. In other words, that you dislike the oppressiveness of truth, if you like, the ability for truth with a capital T to oppress people. Therefore, you doubt the ability to have a kind of objective truth. I mean, I don't really see. I don't really see why, even if it were oppressive to say that something really is the case, that we shouldn't nevertheless say it really is the case, that if something is a fact independent of people's experiences, we should just claim it to be a fact, regardless of its ability to oppress people. I mean, I just don't think I care enough about oppression of people to say, because something is oppressive, we should not really consider it, you know.
Okay, let me give you an example here. Let's say at the beginning of America, this country here, a bunch of Europeans come over to America and They're equipped with some pretty heavy artillery and a belief system in Christianity. It's an objective belief system. You say, okay, if you don't believe in this objective belief system like we do here, because we are the civilized people here, and you Indians, Native American people, savages, okay, so we will say that this is an objective reality, and we really don't care what you think about it, because you know we've grasped this objective reality, and then you better adjust to it. And say, if they resisted to this type of a thing, then the people, the Europeans, can say, okay, well, you are savages, you're subhuman, because you don't agree with us, and you haven't captured the objective reality that we have. We have this reality. So we can, and if you're not going along with us here, and because we want this and this and this from you, we can push you aside, destroy you, kill you off, because we have got the objective reality. So when you say that, that you can't think in terms of oppression, or that, that you make an objective claim, I would say those could be dangerous, in the sense that if you believe that that's so, and you have enough people, like-thinking people, but you have other people who disagree with you, but you don't give them their sway. You don't give them their...
Real quick. You're sounding a little muffled, so I don't know if that's my end or on the... Oh, yeah, that's much better.
Okay. The phone is drifting from my head here.
Okay. There we go. Thank you.
Okay.
I would say that there are certain kinds of investigations, certain kinds of analysis, if you like, that are more susceptible to that than other kinds. So empiricism, science in a very narrow sense of physics and chemistry and biology to some extent, seem to be less susceptible to that than, say, sociology and theology. More social sciences and more kind of sort of armchair philosophy kind of things, where people say, the world must be like this because I believe something, and they don't really bother to look at the world at all.
Right.
So it seems like there's a scale. I mean, one example that I would prefer to use would be in the 1950s that the medical establishment thought homosexuality was a mental disease, and today they don't. And I think that would be a fair case of saying of a situation where scientists had believed something oppressive for cultural reasons rather than medical reasons, perhaps, or rather than empirical reasons. But it seems to me what you're doing is really identifying a political problem with how people are held accountable and how people are questioned and so on. And you're trying to use that really to justify something that's a bit too far, in my opinion. Like that you're going too far. You're saying just because theology and sociology and so on are subject to these kinds of false claims and overstated claims, that even we should be suspicious of physics and chemistry when they make claims about bicarbonate of soda and vinegar. It seems to me that that you really ought to have some way of at least treating certain claims about experience as special in some sense, as incontrovertible. And I'm not really convinced that you have that.
That the expressions are incontrovertible?
Well, it seems to me that you kind of treat all claims the same, regardless of whether they're theological, empirical, or sociological. I mean, other words, that if I were to say that that human sacrifice is required for the salvation of man, or if I were to say that bicarbonate and soda reacts with vinegar, it seems that you would treat both of those things as having the same kind of objective status, and it seems that's probably... That seems to me unreasonable and probably a flaw in whatever framework you want to propose. That you should really have a way of distinguishing between these kinds of claims.
Okay, there is, remember when I said before about the objectivity aspect of the experiential thinking here? There is an objective quality to it, but I can't get into it because it would be too detailed.
Okay.
And actually,
so
I'm going to interject. Real quick, gentlemen, I'm going to interject here. We only have about 5 minutes left or a couple minutes left. But I tell you what, it's been such an interesting conversation. What I'd like to do is at some other time invite Dr. Blonnie to come back so we can deal with these issues in more, or more explanation in more detail of what he's talking about. I think it would definitely be a very interesting discussion.
Okay, that sounds good.
But go ahead just briefly for the next couple of minutes, and then I'm going to have to unfortunately close out the show for the evening. So I'm going to leave the last couple of minutes to our guest this evening, Dr. Blahnik. If you go ahead, and thank you very much for calling in tonight and asking the questions. And I'm pretty excited about you calling over there from the UK. And I hope he answered some of your questions. And as I said, we'd like to have him in here again on the show, and then I'd welcome you to come back on. One way you can see when he'd be coming back on the show is you could follow the show by, I don't know if you just called in, if you followed a link, that you could just go and follow the show by clicking follow under the little icon. But I don't want to take up the rest of the time. I wait for Dr. Blahnik, so go ahead.
For me?
Yes, you.
Oh,
you got the last couple minutes, and then I'm going to do the closing of the show.
Well, I just want to say thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun. I had a good time. Good discussion. The guest was insightful. Had some good questions. Enjoyed it.
Great. Yeah, me too. And thank you to everyone who's coming in to listen to the show, both live and who will be listening to the show on the archives. And thank you everyone in the chat and for your participation and for the other person that called in. Unfortunately, we couldn't get to your call before you hung up. But take care, everyone. Thank you and have a very good night. And as I said, I'd like to have Dr. Blahnik on another time where we can get into details. Like I'm thinking we all would like to have him to be able to. But as he pointed out, Dr. Blahnik pointed out, we just unfortunately did not have the time to go into those details. And I'd really like to do that at another point. Or another time. But everyone take care. I'm going to close this show as I do every show on Bars Logic Political Talk, and that is to play a song from Aubrey Ashburn. And good night, everyone. And enjoy the music.